Hey guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we're going to look into the case of Nolan Wells, an 18-year-old black college athlete whose body was recovered from the waters near Horn Island days after he vanished on July 4th. Was his death an accident? A racially motivated crime? There are several theories out there, and Scoot out of Odyssey station WWL in New Orleans covered them extensively this week. We'll also hear about yet another deadly incident involving ICE agents, this time in Houston, Texas. To end the show, we'll hear discussions of laws that impact violent criminals and national crime statistics. First, we have updates on several crimes across the nation. We'll start today with crimes reported on by Odyssey station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia. This first report is from Tuesday, July 14th.
A 14-year-old is in custody accused of luring, robbing, and killing a pizza delivery driver last month in North Philadelphia. As KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson tells us, a second suspect has not yet been identified.
14-year-old Sincere Camps faces murder, robbery, and related charges connected to the shooting death of Ansel Kuncha. The killing happened on June 5th. An order was placed for Pete's Pizza on Ridge Avenue to an address at 23rd and Edgeley Streets to a vacant home inside a Philadelphia Housing Authority complex. Investigators say 20-year-old Kuncha was delivering the food when the two suspects seen on video approached him, and he put his hands up to show he didn't have anything. Detectives believe that's when he was killed, shot in the back of the head. Officials say the food was found untouched at the abandoned home. There's at least one other person the authorities have not yet identified but believe was involved. Kuncha was from India and was in the U.S. for school, staying with his uncle and working as a delivery driver on the side. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
This KYW report is from Friday, July 17th.
A federal judge peppered a top lawyer within the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office with questions about how he handles federal cases where a defendant is asking for their conviction to be overturned. Here's KYW crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson.
Judge Paul Diamond called the hearing because the DA's office first sided with the defendant that his 2009 murder conviction should be overturned, and then they later recanted, and he's trying to figure out what happened. The first to testify was the DA who handled that federal appeal, Jacqueline Mason, who said she was a pawn used to carry out what her boss, Matt Stiegler, wanted her to do. She said they met with the Innocence Project and the federal defenders and, in her words, colluded to figure out how to overturn the defendant's conviction, and that Stiegler, who has worked as a federal defender, told her that if it was good enough for the Innocence Project, it was good enough for him. She also said that she was never directed to investigate any of the claims, but when Stiegler testified, he told the court he thought she reviewed the file. The judge peppered Stiegler with questions and seemed stunned when he testified that the unit does not independently investigate the appeal claims. The judge also asked him if he believed in the adversarial system of justice, meaning two sides and the judge or jury decide which side wins. Stiegler repeatedly said he viewed his role as making accurate decisions. There are still four others who need to testify, but they will be brought back on another date not yet set. Outside the federal courthouse, Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
KYW also reported on two stabbing incidents this week. Here's one.
Well, police in South Jersey are looking for who stabbed a woman to death at a home in Lindenwald Thursday. Detectives from the Camden County Prosecutor's Office responded to a stabbing along Bilber Avenue near Crowland Avenue around 11:40 in the morning. They found a 53-year-old woman stabbed multiple times. She was taken to the hospital where she died later. Police have no suspects yet or haven't announced any, and they're asking anyone with information to contact the Camden County Prosecutor's Office or Lindenwald Police Department.
And here's the KYW report on that other stabbing incident.
SEPTA says a fight on a bus in North Philly led to a stabbing that sent a man to the hospital. Our partners at NBC 10 says a SEPTA spokesperson says it happened around 3:30 this afternoon near Germantown and Lehigh Avenues. They say it was on the Route 54 bus where the altercation escalated, leading to a man getting wounds to the neck, arm, and face. He got off the bus after the stabbing and went to the hospital. The incident is under investigation. So far, no arrests.
In St. Louis, Odyssey station KMOX reported on a teen facing murder charges.
A 16-year-old now facing murder charges as an adult after a weekend shooting rampage in East St. Louis. Prosecutors have indicted Jamir Davis on a dozen counts after a string of shootings across three separate crime scenes left five people dead and two others wounded. A 15-year-old also in custody. Pastor Mary Young knows some of the people involved. She spoke with Fox 2.
People, please, train up your children. I know they've been trained good. You know, but a lot of times they get influenced by other children or whatever the case may be. This should not be.
We're told prosecutors are pushing to move that second teen to adult court as well. Police have not yet released a motive. We're awaiting more details from St. Louis City Police on an overnight homicide case in the Kingsway West neighborhood. Officers say a man was shot dead outside a gas station in the 1600 block of Union Boulevard just prior to 4 this morning. That's north of Martin Luther King Drive. Lots of evidence markers could be seen around a white Toyota vehicle.
Hey guys, it's Daxton.
And Hayden from Blondies Out Loud.
And if you've ever thought about starting a podcast or making money from one,
we use Creator Lab from Odyssey for our show, and it's honestly been so easy.
It's free hosting, and it gives you a really simple way to earn on top of whatever you're already doing.
Which, of course, we love because it just adds another stream without the extra work.
So, if you're a creator or podcast curious,
check it out at creators.odyssey.com.
In Minnesota, where Vance Belter pleaded guilty to murdering a former lawmaker and her husband and attacking others, Odyssey station WCCO News Talk provided an update on a woman who threatened another state politician.
A September 10th sentencing date has been set for a Hugo woman who threatened Minnesota House Speaker and Republican gubernatorial candidate Lisa Daymuth. 43-year-old Rachel Welsh pleaded guilty to threats of violence, leaving a series of threatening voicemails for Daymuth in January and February, including messages that suggested she was learning to shoot and, quote, was getting really good. A judge granted an extreme risk protection order in the case, which temporarily suspends Welsh's ability to purchase or possess firearms.
Another case with an update this week is the Tanner Horner murder case out of Texas. Here's Odyssey station KRLD in Dallas with the latest.
Yeah, I know you remember the North Texas FedEx driver convicted of murder, sentenced to death earlier this year. Now his attorneys are asking for a new trial. Tanner Horner convicted of capital murder for the murder of 7-year-old Athena Strand. She was taken from a home in Paradise, Texas back in 2022. Horner's attorneys now claim that the sentencing phase of the trial was not fair because of all the publicity surrounding the case. They also claim some defense witnesses declined to testify because they had been harassed.
KRLD also had an update on the Carmelo Anthony case this week.
Story attorneys for a 19-year-old who killed a fellow high school athlete in Frisco last year. They're asking for a new trial.
A jury didn't buy the argument that Carmelo Anthony was acting in self-defense when he stabbed Austin Metcalf to death during a rain delay in a track meet. It convicted him and sentenced him to 35 years in prison. Anthony has a new team of lawyers who claim misconduct by prosecutors during the trial and by the judge afterward. Those attorneys have asked for a new trial and a new judge to preside over it.
It's ABC's Jim Ryan, and their problem with the judge, that stems from a comment he made after the trial.
Judge John Roach Jr. was interviewed by Dallas ABC affiliate WFAA. Asked whether the jury got it right, Roach said it did.
That's the process, and whatever they say, they get it right.
Carmelo Anthony's attorneys say the comment calls Roach's impartiality into question.
I talked to a defense attorney about this, and he said this is going to go nowhere fast.
This is a Hail Mary.
And by the way, this happens on a lot of murder trials. They always ask, there's an appeal, and then they ask for a new trial, so it's not really indifferent, and they're going to pick anything that they can zero in on.
Just in general, the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas, it's very rare that they overturn a conviction.
Yeah, and what the judge was saying was basically, look, this is the process. Right. The jury heard the evidence, and they made a decision.
That's exactly what he was saying. I don't know that he was...
Mike Rogers and Austin York of KRLD's Mid-Morning Mic Check also discussed the recent fatal Immigration and Customs Enforcement incident in Houston. Since the start of the year, federal agents, including ICE agents, have reportedly been responsible for multiple deaths, including the ICE killing of American citizen Renee Good and the killing of Alex Preddy, both in Minnesota.
Interesting twist to the shooting death of a Mexican national in Houston by ICE.
The Department of Homeland Security admitting the man shot and killed by ICE in Houston Tuesday was not the intended target of their investigation. In a statement, a DHS official now saying 52-year-old Lorenzo Salgado Araujo, a husband and father of three, was stopped by ICE because he resembled the target of an investigation, causing officers to stop his van. Salgado Araujo was then shot in the abdomen by an ICE officer. The agency claiming the officer acted in self-defense.
They say that he wasn't following orders and that he tried to run over an ICE officer. However,
the Washington Post now reporting migrants who were in the car with Salgado Araujo through statements given to their lawyer dispute key parts of ICE's narrative. One writing, it is impossible for them to say that they were going to get run over. There were no officers in front of or behind the vehicle. They were on the sides.
So they're two completely different stories. And if there's any video out there, I guess we're going to find out soon enough.
The shooting sending shockwaves through Houston. Salgado Araujo, an undocumented immigrant living in the U.S. for 35 years, was close to obtaining legal immigration status, his son said.
Undocumented migrants are humans.
They're demanding an independent investigation.
ABC's Jay O'Brien. This is what I was saying yesterday. No matter which side of this you're on, wait until all the facts come in.
Absolutely.
Right?
And, I mentioned this yesterday with Eddie Garcia, who used to be the Dallas police chief, now over at Fort Worth. He always said you should praise officers when they do well, but hold them accountable. Hold the department accountable. When they make a mistake. And if that's the case, that's what you have to do here. Be transparent. I guess officials in ICE officials in Houston are holding a press conference right now to discuss this case. So we'll bring you any kind of updates that they say.
Odyssey station KCBS Radio in the Bay Area reported that President Donald Trump's administration ordered ICE to halt most vehicle stop operations after two recent enforcement actions ended in fatal shootings. Professor of Immigration Law and Policy at the University of San Francisco, Bill Hing, joined the station to discuss the issue with Margie Schaefer.
This is a significant policy shift for ICE. What does suspending most vehicle stops tell you about what the administration's concerns are?
Well, I think that they are understanding that the public and other leaders, political leaders around the country are in disbelief that these policies of vehicle pursuits have been allowed to continue because they've ended in such tragedy. One in Minneapolis, and which we all, that was Renee Good, and then the gentleman in Houston last week, and now this one in Maine a day or two ago, that it tells us that they are capable of responding to reasonable pressure to at least temporarily cease a procedure that's led to these deaths.
The administration says it's a temporary pause while agents receive additional training. What would that training be?
That's a really good question, Margie, because I was on the San Francisco Police Commission for a couple of years, and I'm familiar with the policies dealing with vehicle pursuits locally and at the state level and in other jurisdictions. And the long and short of it is that you're not supposed to engage in vehicle pursuits because the pursuit itself can become deadly. And so the kind of training they need, which apparently they haven't had, is when is it proper to engage and when is it a better idea to disengage, because otherwise you might endanger innocent bystanders. Now in this situation, what's interesting is in both Houston and Maine, they acknowledge that the people that ended up being shot were not the original targets of their pursuit. And so that tells us even more that they've got to have better training on, listen, if you're after somebody who's a criminal or somebody who's has not shown up at their deportation hearings and might be dangerous, that's one thing. But if you can't find them, it doesn't give you the excuse to continue pursuing someone who you don't even know who it is.
That's right. I mean, this has been especially tragic. Can you talk about, you know, the authority that ICE has, well, at least had and may have again, to stop a vehicle during immigration enforcement versus how it's different from a routine traffic stop conducted by police?
Great question. As we all know, and many of us have experienced, when we are when we violated a traffic code, run a stop sign or not stop, that kind of thing, and it's in plain view, the police can stop us from doing that, or if we're driving erratically, that's a reasonable thing. Now, ICE officials can also stop people for traffic violations, which is a very controversial thing, but they claim that they can stop people for traffic violations, and that isn't what happened in this situation. But other than that, they are limited to the Constitution. The Constitution says they can only pursue someone if they have reasonable suspicion that the person is undocumented or deportable. And so if they have a license plate of somebody that they know is deportable, who has been convicted of a crime, they can probably go after that car. But if they don't, they don't have the authority to do that. So in summary, they can't go after someone just because, oh, that person looks, they're guessing that that person's undocumented, because that just isn't, that's not sustainable. You can't racially profile somebody and get away with it.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. As we approach America's 250th anniversary, now might be the time to go back and learn how we got here. With more than 200 episodes, you can binge your way, decade by decade, defining event to defining event, from the founding into the 20th century. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now on to the big mystery of our show this week. What exactly happened to Nolan Wells, the 18-year-old young man who was found dead in the waters around Horn Island, Mississippi, after July 4th celebrations? Scoot from Odyssey station WWL has been following the story. He'll fill us in on the details.
So we've been talking about the case of the 18-year-old who died on Horn Island. So I'm getting some really interesting text, and I don't know really what happened. All I know is what I'm hearing in the news. I'm trying to put it together and share it with you so it makes sense. But I love the information that I'm getting. And so there is one train of thought that there was some kind of problem, and he ended up dead, and then they brought his body back to Horn Island. The thing that doesn't make sense about that is the idea that he wanted to be on Horn Island to maybe kind of hang out with this girl and talk to this girl. And you know, if you're a guy and you're straight, friends with your guy friends, that's one thing. But if you get a chance to knack on a girl, if you get a chance to, you know, flirt with a girl because you kind of got a crush on her, that supersedes your male friends. Hey, you guys can go. I'll get a ride back with her. I'm gonna hang out with her. But that doesn't explain what happened and how he ended up dead. And I guess the other thing that I'm concerned about with Nolan Wells is he died July 4th. His body wasn't found until July 6th. It seems like he was always in somebody's company. It doesn't seem like he was ever alone. So somebody had to see what happened. And if the person who saw something happen was involved in any way, they're not going to come forward. But doesn't it sound like he was never really alone? But yet it seemed like he ended up alone and dead in the water. But they have not said yet that he died from drowning. So as far as I know, we don't yet know how he drowned, or I mean how he died, whether it was drowning or something else. I don't think we know that yet. But I mean, it only takes so long to do the autopsy and to send the evidence off and then to get it back. It only takes so long. So we should know something soon about the cause of death. I mean, that would be an obvious thing. An autopsy's been done. What's the cause of death? That's what we need to know. That's going to tell us a hell of a lot. If he drowned, okay, how did he drown? And who was there when he drowned? Or did he just go off on his own? And why was he off on his own if he did not have a way back to the mainland from the island? I mean, if you didn't have a boat ride back to the coast from the island, you wouldn't want to be alone. So it seems like he had to always be with somebody. Or was he killed in some other way? Or did he die in some freak accident and ended up in the water? Again, these are just questions. We don't know. But it should not take long to get the autopsy results back. And then we'll know a lot how he died.
One caller dialed into Scoot's show to explain why some people are concerned that Wells may have been the victim of a racially motivated crime, and why some people are frustrated at the way his case has been represented.
I fully believe that if the situation were to be reversed, those boys would have been arrested immediately, and no bond and no high-priced lawyer would have saved them.
Yeah, that is very possible.
Okay.
It's probable.
Okay.
That's probable.
Now, I don't just... That's fine.
And I appreciate
you
calling.
You may not recognize my name, but I'm the mother of a murdered child.
I'm
Boogie B's mother.
Okay. So
the comedian the comedian that was killed in Ralph's parking lot was my son.
Yeah. I am.
Okay. So this whole situation has me triggered.
I understand.
And what I am tired of is people, not you, let's be clear, not you, but there are voices out there who are making it seem like this whole, the way that's being handled is normal and reasonable, and it is not. I think it's my personal opinion, no proof. But I think if one of those mothers wasn't a judge, it wouldn't be going down this way.
You know, it doesn't look good. I understand the point you're making, Geraldine. And look, mm-hmm. I cannot relate to your perspective on life, because you had a son taken from you. So I'm not even going to pass judgment on your opinion. I can't see life the way you do because of what you've been through. And I'm sorry that you went through that. And I do think you bring up a legitimate point about what if the situation had been turned around. And just bringing that up causes us to address that issue that is not fair.
As the week continued, Scoot continued to look into the case.
I wrote a blog about this. It should be posted on our website, WWL.com. It should also be posted on Scoot on the Air Facebook. And you can comment on it there, and I'll try to get to some of your comments later. But I want to share the latest. If you missed our show late yesterday, I just kind of put it all together. And there are still a lot of questions and a lot of rumors and a lot of conspiracy theories. So, you know, if you know any, if you have heard anything, I mean, sometimes conspiracy theories really lead to the truth, because sometimes the way the facts are presented are not exactly the way that it really happened. Even with the controversy, the death of this 18-year-old Dolan Wells is a heartbreaking tragedy. But the truth about what happened is important for a number of reasons. From the beginning of this sad news that a teenager ready to enter Southwest Louisiana Mississippi Community College, he died on Horn Island in the Mississippi Sound. From the beginning of this, this was a high-profile case, but I didn't understand why civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump was involved. The story of the death of this 18-year-old exploded into a national news story with Crump and the parents of Nolan Wells appearing on all the national network news shows. Now, my initial suspicion about Crump's involvement was not to discount racism, but it was really about not understanding why racism was part of this, because nothing that I heard just jumped out at me as being racist. You know, the fact that the teen who died was black and his friends were white, that should not automatically cause people to think about racism. So for a young generation, I mean, and think about this, and I know you see this if you have kids or grandkids, for young generations, the friendships between the races are seamless compared to the unfortunate judgment that still lives among the boomer generation. But there is a link. But if there is a link between the teen's death and racism, then I think we need to know. Nolan Wells was apparently on this last big party escape before reporting to football camp at the community college that he was going to be attending. Nolan was with friends, and together they traveled to Horn Island in the Mississippi Sound. Horn Island is uninhabited, and here's what you need to know about the island. It's a barrier island off the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and depending on your departure point, whether it's Biloxi, Gulfport, or Ocean Springs, and the speed of your boat and the water conditions, the island is a 20-minute to an hour boat ride from the coast. Horn Island is uninhabited, like I say. Ship Island has this, you know, massive convenience store and shops. I haven't been to Ship Island in a while, but that's the last I remember. But Horn Island is essentially uninhabited, and it does lack that large concession area that is on nearby Ship Island. There are also no phones, and there's no phone service on Horn Island. The island is a desirable destination by boat because the water on the southern shore of Horn Island, the other side of Horn Island, is clear compared to the water of the Mississippi Sound. It's kind of like Gulf Shores. Maybe not quite that clear, but when you get on the other side of Ship Island, the other side of Cat Island, the other side of Horn Island, the water's really nice. And so a lot of people with boats, they will go to Horn Island or Ship Island and recreate. So Nolan Wells and his friends ventured to Horn Island for recreation. At some point, Wells separated from his friends with the understanding that he would get a ride in a boat back to the Mississippi coast with someone else. Away from the group of friends, Wells disappeared on July 4th, and his body was discovered in the water at the northwest corner of Horn Island on July the 6th, 2 days later. Apparently, his friends had possession of his cell phone, which is quite curious. Mississippi authorities said that there were pictures of the teens drinking beer, but there was no indication that Nolan's blood alcohol had reached the level of intoxication. Authorities also said that there were no signs of a crime being committed. Social media activity has been downloaded. It's being processed right now to try to corroborate some of the information that is available. Now, the mother of one of the teens, one of the white teens with Nolan before he broke away from the group, Jackson County Judge Ashley Cole, she has reported death threats against her and her family. And she says that just like everybody else, they want to find out what happened to this young man. Now, while talking about this latest information on the show yesterday, I got a text from someone who said there's suspicion because the mother, who's a judge, was interfering in the case, which suggests some kind of cover-up, perhaps, some kind of manipulation of the facts. If that's true, I have not found any real credible evidence that there was interference or a cover-up. But that leads to even more questions. Why did Nolan Wells break away from his group of friends? Who was he going to get a ride back with? I mean, you know, you're on Horn Island and you don't have a boat and you break away from your friends who have a boat. Are you sure you're going to be able to get a ride back? And who are you going to get a ride with? Was there any argument or altercation? Did the other teens have Nolan's cell phone? You know, there are still a lot of questions which, need to be answered. And look, you know, parents can order an independent investigation if they think something is wrong. And there is an investigation going on. And attorney Benjamin Crump, I guess, is part of that. Is he spearheading the investigation or the parents? I'm not sure. And what are the theories that point to racism being a factor in the death of Nolan Wells? I'm not saying racism isn't part of it, but what are the facts that lead people in that direction? Now, I understand that parents, you know, want their kids to always do what they tell them to do. But the truth is, a lot of teenagers, especially older teens like 18 years old, they don't always do what their parents tell them to do. But the tragic death of Nolan Wells on Horn Island does yield more questions than answers. Appearing on ABC's Good Morning America, Nolan's father, Elmore Wansley, said, "We always taught him, if you go with a group, you stay with a group. If you go with five, you come back with five. Do not separate from the group because, I always said, there's safety in numbers." So he knew to stay with the group. So why would he split from the group? I don't know. Christine Wansley, the mother, said that she could not imagine her son leaving the group and being alone. So what happened here? I mean, I know our kids don't always do exactly what we think they're going to do. As much as we hope that our kids will listen to us, the truth is they don't always listen to us. Or something comes up that is more enticing. Everything that happened is not the result of racism. Everything that happens in general is not the result of racism. However, racism could be a factor, and we could learn about that. I think it would be sad if racism is part of this. But if it is, I think we need to know and maybe try to learn from it. In the case of Nolan Wells' death, it's important to know if racism was a factor. Was it some kind of motivation? Was there a cover-up? If you know anything, if you have heard or read anything, you know, even on social media, I'll entertain that. So I think the parents have every right to their independent investigation and to hire Benjamin Crump. I hope this isn't about racism, but no matter what, an 18-year-old teen is dead. And that is tragic. That is heartbreaking. So it's not like it's going to be some kind of relief if we discover that it was racism. I mean, it's still a tragedy. But if the issue is about race, then that's really sad because things don't have to be about race. We make things about race, and there shouldn't be anything about race. I'm really interested to see what results come because I hope there's nothing that involves racism. But that's not going to give me a sigh of relief because an 18-year-old is still dead. So, you know, we don't know what happened here. But if you have read or heard anything that I haven't heard or read, and you want to share that with us, all right, we'll see if anybody has read or heard anything more about the case because, again, missing July 4th, body found in the water July 6th, he leaves his friends. They might have his cell phone. I don't know, man. There are a lot of questions here. I still don't see the connection with racism, but I'm not saying it doesn't exist. We've been talking about a number of things. The latest on the Nolan Wells case, they went to the family went and had a meeting along with Benjamin Crump, their attorney, had a meeting with the DA in Jackson County, Mississippi, and everybody seemed happy with the meeting. I still have a question about why Jackson County hasn't released more information about the cause of death, even if it's preliminary information. That's something that I thought sort of naturally came out. And why, if it is this true, did his friends, the people who left him because he wanted to stay behind? I mean, I don't think it's a case of they just left him. Hey, the hell with you, you know, F you, we're going. No, I think he wanted to stay back on the island to hang out with this girl. So they leave, but if they did scrub their phones, if they did erase all of the activities of the day from their phones, why did they do that? I mean, of course, if they're drinking, they're underage at 18. and whether or not 18-year-olds should be allowed to drink. That's a topic for another show that I'm sure we'll get to. I mean, when I was growing up, you could be 18. You have to be 18 to go in the military, and if you can go fight for our country, are you old enough to drink? Those are legitimate questions, but we're not going to get into that today. So, you know, if they did erase their phones, why did they do that? And it seems like there are some sketchy questions about the death of 18-year-old Nolan Wells, and, you know, we'll do the best we can to keep you in touch with all that is going on.
Dana Wright and Sam Stevie III of the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City discuss the fate of certain violent criminals who have actually served their sentences. Let's listen in.
And then this story that for all 30 years of my career has puzzled me with respect to how it is legal to do what we do. And I'm not saying I disagree with it. I'm just saying I don't understand how it's legal.
Okay.
On the Missouri side, the Attorney General today has moved to permanently commit a repeat sex offender who was one day from release. And we do this all the time, by the way. Missouri Attorney General Catherine Hanaway filed today to civilly commit a repeat sex offender who was one day from release. 42-year-old Benjamin Waltz was scheduled for release this week. He will now remain in custody while the proceedings against him to commit him civilly move forward, okay? The AG notes that the Johnson County Sheriff's Office referred Waltz to her office for review after his probation was revoked following a recent arrest. And here we go. He, despite a long criminal history of sex offenses, failed to register as a sex offender, number one, was found loitering near a school in the Warrensburg area, number two. Oh, wait for it, allegedly sexually assaulted a woman in the Warrensburg area. Court records show that Sheriff's Office formally notified the AG on April 15th that Waltz had a prior conviction for a sexually violent offense and had committed recent overt acts on top of his original conviction. Under Missouri law, as any act that creates a reasonable apprehension of harm of a sexually violent nature, you are able to commit these men and women, although I think it's predominantly men. In 2002, he was convicted of sexual battery in Florida. In 2011, convicted of felonious kidnapping. 2020, convicted of second-degree sexual abuse. And 2024, violated numerous sex offender registration requirements.
Because they're proving to be an ongoing threat. That's
absolutely.
Obviously not going to get the picture
absolutely.
Of, hey, you can't be doing this, you weirdo.
In addition to his convictions, the AG office says Walt has multiple arrests for incidents of a sexual nature that either didn't result in charges or for whatever reason, charges were later dismissed. And we all know that doesn't mean he didn't do it. It just means procedurally, there are a slew of other cases that did not see their way all the way through court. Okay.
Right.
So what happens now? They do this mental health evaluation under our laws. And I think it's in Kansas and Missouri. They go to Larned. I'd have to look this up.
I do believe so.
You
yeah.
can continue to keep someone that we believe is an ongoing threat only in these sexually violent cases.
Good.
And I'm not saying I don't want these people locked up. In a million years, you would not want this guy living next to you or your daughter or your granddaughter. He is a repeat sexual deviant offender. I've never understood how this got through the court system, though, that once you have served your sentence, a state can then say, we're going to move you from padded cell A to a mental place B.
Because obviously—
So that you can no longer offend. Because, Sam, people reoffend all the time for a million different crimes.
Well, I mean, does that not deserve some of the same conversation? We talk about the guy along Indian Creek who is accused of killing seven people and has been in and out of the competency investigation for the last, almost 10 years now?
In a perfect world to me, you put these offenders away the first time. God knows the second time. I mean, he had four that I just
repeated between 2002 and 2024.
And those were cases that stuck.
You put them away and you throw away the key.
Yeah.
I've never understood how it's legal under our Constitution that once they serve their sentence, as short as that may be, we can then recommit them somewhere else. And again, I am not here to advocate for the release of these nuts. You would not want to be anywhere near one of these men.
Well, and 30, 40 years ago, that wouldn't even have been a thought that you had, because that was the common practice. So does the Constitution have anything to do about it? Did it go to a constitutional court back then?
I think it's been through the court, Sam. And for whatever reason, when it comes to a violent sexual predator who cannot seem to stay out of trouble, it is legal to put them away. And again, I am thrilled they are putting them away. I just don't understand under our system of laws how we can do it. Or we should be able to put everyone away that can't. You know what I mean? Like, you can't stop stealing.
I mean, we did that for a while.
He will undergo a full evaluation by the Department of Mental Health, and then a judge will determine whether he should be civilly committed as a sexually violent predator.
I want to key on that one for a second. Why do we need to give him a mental health evaluation? We can look at his actions and pretty well figure out how he's doing upstairs.
Because if you're going to take someone's freedom away after they've served their sentence, I think you have to go through that process.
But the mental health evaluation would be whether or not
he's nuts. Competent. He's a sexually deviant.
No, he's not competent.
Well, I don't know if it's competency. It's, is he sexually deviant? And the answer is yes.
Got it.
The answer is most certainly yes.
Tommy Tucker, another host out of WWL in New Orleans, spoke to Ronald Serpas about crime statistics both locally and nationwide in an interview this week.
At this time, there are about 1,400 people in Orleans Parish Prison. A significant, overwhelming majority are in there for serious violent crimes, and they're being held in custody pending the outcome of their trials because they're such serious crimes. I'll agree with that for this reasons on a couple. One, there's only about 1-2% of your city that ever wants to get involved in serious violent crime. That's a fact. We know it. I know it. Everybody knows it. So if they're held because they are serious offenders, that's good. Two, let's look back, step back, Tommy, since COVID. The one thing that we need to say, and this isn't meant to start any fights with anybody, but murders and violent crime is going down across the country. It's going down in red states. It's going down in blue states, big cities, small cities, urban cities. Cities that had National Guard and federal government enforcement activity and support, and cities that different. That lends us to have more idea that this isn't really one mayor's great job or one police chief's great job. There's something in the system that's changing. There's something that's coming up in the numbers of people who are willing to commit crimes. The second thing, and I've always been very focused on this, when the police officers are allowed to be deployed and used in proactive policing, which is the only scientifically proven form of policing that works, and they give better cases to prosecutors because they're doing that kind of directed proactive policing. Prosecutors have stronger cases. People may be held longer in prison as incapacitated, which could reduce crime. That's where I think some of what I'm saying and Rafi's pointed out kind of come together. I will share this with you. Very few people in your community want to do these types of crimes. And when the police can focus on them and legally and justifiably incapacitate their criminal behavior, and prosecutors can work with that, we can see crime go down. The question is the police department being proactive? I believe Chief Kirkpatrick, when she says they are. I think the data starts to support that. But really, it's going on all over the country, so it's a little early for any one plan to say that was the most successful. But going down around the country is a good thing.
So what systemically could have changed around the country, specifically after COVID?
Yeah, there's certainly there are some people in the criminology world who think that COVID was such a disruptor that it's now taken the nation a few years to kind of come back to a status quo. I don't think that's necessarily wrong. My experience in policing continues to be the same. A very small number of people want to commit crimes. That's who we should focus on.
Well, what does that mean, disruptor, as far as gang activity or as far as the criminal activity?
Everything. This is what some criminologists think, that COVID was such a dramatic change to the way we live our lives, mm-hmm. that some of these things got out of control and out of whack. And now we're starting to kind of come back. That's what they said. I'm not really sure I get a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I think we're back to normal life after COVID. I'll accept that. I think that better deployed police even though if they're short staffed, are doing those kinds of cases, they can make a huge difference. If they're bringing good cases to prosecutors with good witness participation, they can get dangerous people off the community, i.e. there's only so many really dangerous people. That's what I think is probably going on here. I also think, Tommy, we all know this in the academic world right now. It's called the birth cohort cliff. And that means that right now we have the lowest number of 18-year-olds as a number of people. And they are at a small birth rate because after the 2008 recession, people started slowing birth rates. So think about that. The crime-prone age is 18 to 24. Mm-hmm. If we have less 18 to 24-year-old people like we did in the early 2000s, that could also be contributing to that very small number of people who want to commit crime. See the point?
Sure.
So there's a lot of things that are moving in the same direction at this moment in time. I think in my 47-year career, we've seen this happen a couple other times in the last four decades that could have been attributed to some of the same things we're talking about today. Less people are being hurt.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WCCO News and Talk in the Twin Cities, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, KRLD 1080 in Dallas, KCBS Radio in the Bay Area, the Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, and both Scoot and Tommy Tucker out of WWL in New Orleans. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.